Okay, Bill, we want to thank you for being our guest speaker with us today, and we're looking forward to speaking with you about all of your acquisition experience and the things you've been doing through your illustrious career. And because I wouldn't get it right, how about if you start by giving us a little bit of background on your career, and then we can go from there.
Sure, no, ha happy to do so. I've started off in acquisition back in the 80s with the what was then called the General Accounting Office. And through a number of years there, I eventually was able to land a job up on Capitol Hill with Senator Bill Cohen in the early 90s. And there I worked on what's called the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the Clinger-Cohen Act. I stayed up there on the Government Affairs Committee for several years, ultimately with Chairman at the time, Fred Thompson, and then we made my way over to the Senate Armed Services Committee, all the time doing general government management issues, acquisition issues, budget issues, personnel, information technology, and so on. I left the Armed Services Committee to go to the Pentagon to be the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Industrial Policy, a position that has changed in name and function for the last, 50 years. After that, I got some industry experience, went back to the House Appropriations Committee on their investigation side, did some stint at the think tanks. And then in 2015, Senator McCain asked me to come back to the Armed Services Committee to essentially reform acquisition to make us competitive against China and to bring in non-traditional defense contractors into our industrial base. I did that for several years and eventually was able to retire from the government and I'm now consulting and still trying to keep us competitive with China.
That's outstanding. Well, having been in the acquisition business for 50 years and struggled with all those policies and things you can do from those Pentagon positions, I feel that the work that you were helping spearhead with this OTA, Other Transaction Authority contracting, is the biggest potential improvement to acquisition I've ever seen. Not that there isn't still a lot of bureaucratic issues that reside. So, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into that line of thinking and where it came from?
Sure. It actually, I mean, Other Transactions goes all the way back in history to the Space Act with NASA. And that's actually an interesting point to hold on, and we'll come back to it. When I came to the Hill, we were trying to figure out a way of how to bring in commercial innovation. This is in the 90s. And so we created an alternative acquisition system called FAR Part 12, Commercial Item Procurement. It was the failure of commercial item procurement, the inability to actually incentivize the commercial sector to do more than just providing commercial products to the department, but to actually innovate on behalf of the department, that we started trying to figure out a way how to take the old Other Transactions Authority and beef it up. And the reality is that's taken about 30 years in the Department of Defense. And it really wouldn't have happened except for Senator John McCain, who essentially was having conversations with Elon Musk and learning about how NASA, using the Space Act and using other transactions, was able to open up the aperture and create a really an alternative non-traditional capability in space launch. And when I came up there, that's what he wanted me to do, is to figure out how can we create 1,000 space X's in the Department of Defense using this type of authority. So we massaged it, we changed it, we created a cradle to grave other transactions, alternative contracting and acquisition system. And that's what we have today.
Jim, I know you've had some experience recently with OTAs. Do you want to comment about what you're seeing?
First I want to make a comment. I started a company in 1997, and I purposely started it as a FAR Part 12 company. Because I didn't want to get into DCAA, and I was a believer of the Acquisition Streamlining Act of 1995. But I will tell you, I was a small business. I had more large prime contractors basically say, "Well, you can't do this because you're not a commercial company." And I had to like prove that I was doing commercial work. But it was almost like I was a threat to the various integrators and support CETA contractors who were out there. So it was very frustrating. Fast forward, I'm currently at KBR, which we were primarily a company called Centauri back last year. And we bought a company in a couple of years ago called Cord Technologies out of Huntsville. And they have been very successful. I would say the Army is doing great things with the Rapid Critical Capabilities Office out of Army Futures Command and General Neil Thurgood, where they're using OTAs to what I would say is probably something that people should see what they're doing and use as a perfect example how they're taking a larger opportunity, a larger problem, and instead of taking 6 to 8 years to solve it, they're solving it in 2 to 3 years.
So, Bill, in my own experience here with the Navy, these folks in the NAVOR System Center here and System Command down here in San Diego, I spearheaded the OTA around this organization before anybody really realized that the bill had been passed and that it was in the authorization. And so educating them to how to do that was a long, slow road, but they eventually sort of got on and tried to do it. But then, of course, the antibodies came out. So immediately what happened is, even though you don't need a contracting officer to do other OTAs, these folks made a contracting officer the requirement, and it goes on and on. And what I find is that these program management leaders, for whatever reason, over their current careers of 20, 30 years, they basically bow down to the lawyers and the contracting officers and do whatever they tell them to do, independent of what they think they need for their program. How does that reflect on what you guys went through and have been thinking about this stuff?
I mean, really, we saw a sea change in the 1980s. And ever since that time, the power of program managers has been dissipated into practically nothing. Correct. And at one time, the program manager led the office and the supporting units actually supported them rather than taking their own power and driving solutions. So yeah, this is something, and one of the things I wanted to do and I wasn't able to do before I left was to really focus in this program manager, contracting officer / legal / other stovepipe relationships, and really try to figure out how to empower the program manager again, because unfortunately each of the stovepipes is maximizing their power to the detriment of national security.
Well, one of the things that has been a theme of mine for a while, just because I lived through the whole transition between before and after Goldwater Nichols, is as I reflect on the Navy, I can't speak to the Air Force and the Army's programs very much, although I was a little bit involved with the Futures program for the Army. But as I reflect on it, I don't think the Navy has done a good job of building any large acquisition program, be it a ship like LCS or Zumwalt, or the aircraft like the F-35s, since Goldwater Nichols in any efficient or effective kind of way. In other words, they never meet cost, performance, or schedule, as opposed to Wayne Meyer, who built the Aegis fleet, never missed cost, performance, and schedule, and had the support of Congress because of that ability.
Yeah, I think the Navy has, and actually say DOD to a large degree, has taken on pretty much embraced an ideology of prediction, of linear thinking, of the compliance mentality of checking the boxes in so many different areas that it's lost sight of innovation, it's lost sight of time, and I think time is probably the most important factor in acquisition that we've just given up on. And because of that, there's this alternative reality of trying to predict in a 15 to 20 year time frame. They're never going to make it. They can predict in a shorter period of time. And that's why people can come in when they do it right, can come into their and meet their predictive milestones. But we've lost touch with that and lost the ability to be, it's ironic that the desire to be risk averse is actually leading to worse acquisition outcomes.
So, Bill, do you see, I mean, obviously Senator McCain passed. Is there somebody driving OTAs to where maybe we come to a situation where they mandate specific programs to use OTAs? Because we're seeing a lot of RFIs come around, like asking what kind of procurement we should use, what kind of contract vehicle we should use. And, you know, obviously if a company has a large Mac or a large BPA, they're going to push the vehicle they already have, as opposed to saying, hey, let's use an OTA. And, you know, that's question one. And then question two, we've seen that even a large non-traditional company can own a non-traditional company. And I just wonder how long that's going to, you know, stay relevant, because at some point somebody's going to complain, like, how can a big company own a non-traditional? So I just wonder if you could address those two questions.
Yeah, no, I think the department, you know, getting back to the fact that McCain is no longer here is a key and frankly, a difficult obstacle for us to deal with. There is no leadership out there in the department or in the Congress that is driving this to the degree that he did, and understands the relationship between the need for an alternative system to innovate. And so because the knowledge base is not so great in the political side, both in on the Hill and in the administration, there's a danger that those traditional ways of doing business are going to crop up again. And the easiest route to go is exactly that, is to go with a traditional contractor we've always gone with, to go to traditional vehicles, to essentially not innovate because we don't want to deal with those new crazy people out in Austin or Boston or Silicon Valley. So, you know, there's a desire to do that. And so it's going to take leadership and frankly, a culture change. We talk about that probably later to achieve that. The second issue, there are going to be some real, you know, I mean, there are going to be some mistakes made in other transactions, no doubt about it. But the concern of why we defined the ability of a big traditional to own a non-traditional was so they didn't destroy it. So their culture didn't take one of these non-traditional companies and make it a compliant traditional contractor and just destroy its ability to innovate. So that is in the law. I know there are some people can, you know, have kind of scratched their head about that, but that's really the reality. And the hope down the line is that we can allow the traditionals to become freer and become more like the non-traditional community than, frankly, what we have today, which is a compliance-based, risk-averse, industrial base, which provides monopoly services to the Department of Defense.
So to your point about timelines creeping way out, one of my observations has always been that program managers who stay 3 or 4 years, arguably, never complete more than a small percentage of the work that it takes to build these 20, 25-year programs, as opposed to when we had a Wayne Meyer that sat there for 13 years and went from original concept to the ships on the line. And same thing can be said for Rickover, same thing can be said for Walt Lock on the cruise missiles. I mean, it goes on and on, right? But we today never have anybody that sits in an office long enough to be responsible for anything, nor are they ever held responsible for anything. And I don't know how we turn that around or what can be done about that.
Well, I'll take us back in history. You know, when Rickover was just starting, how many submarine classes came out in the 1950s? You know, we were deploying new submarines in new class submarines in less than 3 to 5 years.
Right.
Deploying everything in less than 3 to 5 years. Our whole acquisition system was revolved around time and getting capability out to the warfighter. And we went through a sea change in the 1960s and 70s that created a new budget system, acquisition system, requirement system, contracting system that changed all of that. So I'm going to throw out something pretty radical, which now is in statute, which is to essentially focus acquisition systems, not on 20, 25 years. Matter of fact, that's our problem. We need to focus acquisition systems on 2-year systems, on 3-year systems, on 5-year systems, and then figure out how to augment them as we go forward. So the mid-tier acquisition authority, which essentially goes around the requirements, right, and the acquisition 5000 system, is designed exactly to do that. And to show you how successful it can be, a time-based manner married up to other transactions, which essentially goes around the contracting system, all you have to do is look at you know, the fact that our freedom is coming up very quickly because we've got vaccines. Why do we have vaccines? Because we had a innovative program that dealt with time and was married up to DOD's other transactions authority, plus Defense Production Act authority, emergency authorities, to drive innovation as quickly as possible. That's what we need to do. And if we start thinking in 25 year cycles again, you know, the Chinese are going to out innovate us, you know, five cycles while we're figuring out what we're going to do.
Well, to your point, you mentioned SpaceX earlier. I find myself completely fascinated by what Elon Musk and SpaceX has accomplished, because you and I probably both remember that we always had to spend $10,000 to $15,000 per pound to put anything in space through all those years that we ran all those contracts to build new rockets and new boosters. And he comes along, he's already putting men in the space station for $1,000 a pound and 60 satellites at a time to populate his Starlink satellites. And his Starship is postulated to put stuff in space for $25 a pound. I mean, that's like you and I going to the grocery store for $25 a pound. It's just totally amazing to me that we can even do that. And unfortunately, he didn't get involved in anything that had to do with the government and OTAs.
well, in a sense, but he did. Essentially, the NASA, you know, created an OTA for him to provide launch as a service and gave him the financial backing so that he could actually do that. And so he, the only conversation I've ever had with him was about OTAs. And he was one of the most knowledgeable CEOs, this is back in 2005, 2006, on OTAs than anyone I've ever talked to. Then, before that and since, he got it. He got it that this rule change allowed him to innovate. And the benefits of this, think about this, NASA came out and said, if we were to do this traditionally, it would have cost, you know, nine times what we did. So in other words, he did this for 10% on the dollar to produce Falcon and all, you know, and the launch system. So when you start thinking about that, that means there's 90% of what we do is in bureaucracy and compliance and disincentives to the traditional industrial base. We've got to figure out how to, you know, incentivize more people like Elon Musk to do what he did, because it can be done. And even more important, it's not radical. He went back to the model that essentially was the late 1950s DOD model. And so I think that's where we have, we almost have to go back to the future to get to become more competitive.
Thanks for reminding me that was OTAs. I didn't know that. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. Oh, I've heard some discussion about taking kind of the venture capital Silicon Valley mindset, right, and put more VC mentality into the acquisition world, where, and I think you mentioned it early, I don't do an SBIR where you have 3 years to deliver or 4 years to deliver a solution. You have a year to show something, or, you know, a minimum viable product in a year. And if you don't, you're going to lose your funding, right? And again, a different mindset, different culture change, but that's kind of how, you know, the VC world works, right? You have to show stuff to get us another round of funding.
We didn't mention yet, but the really my favorite part about OTAs is it's prototypes. It's all about prototypes. All the government has to do is ask for anybody who can do a prototype of a particular area, as opposed to us messing around with formalized requirements that go back and forth and back and forth, and the contractors don't get them right or do get them right. And that is a big, long argument. If you just say build something as a prototype and then OTA allows you to take it to sole source if it works, that's phenomenal.
And that goes back again to our history. And frankly, the history of Silicon Valley. You know, Silicon Valley came out of the Department of Defense in the 50s and the 60s. And at that time, the department, I mean, all these big programs, the new classes, the new ICBMs, the new reconnaissance, these were all prototypes. They were operational prototypes, but they were basically build me something that works, that can be operationally effective. And that is the what we did. And when the department destroyed this, the department and Congress both destroyed this innovation system, who was left to carry it on but Silicon Valley? And the same type of prototyping mentality, the same type of time-based mentality, the ability to fund things, and if they don't work, cut them off and move on to the next one. that was DoD's culture that no longer exists, but it does still exist in Silicon Valley. And so I think that's where the department has to come back to, and it has to come back to its roots, because they were really good at it. They were did exactly that: operational prototypes, capability, get it out of the field, and then improve upon it. And that's exactly what Silicon Valley does: prototype, version A, B, C, D, and move out until they have something that's really, really effective.
Yeah, even to the point that Microsoft let us be their prototype users, right? All the time. So let's go back to the Goldwater Nichols again for a second. You obviously spent a good portion of your career on the political side. I've spent some of my career on that side. And so one of my complaints about the Goldwater Nichols is when we moved the decision authority for programs from the operational mission side, like we had when we were building Aegis, for example, over to the new Goldwater Nichols, AT&L acquisition authority and the RDAs of the services, then what we did is we tied the vagaries and the machinations of politics to those decision processes. And then in the process, we put massive processes in place that caused 100 briefs before you could get any decision brief on any program. So that seemed to me to be one of the negatives of what Goldwater Nichols did. And it's also creating the antibodies that are preventing them from moving into this OTA prototype world the way you guys have authorized it.
Goldwater Nichols and the Packard Commission were the culmination of centralized planning or the planning system in DoD. And we haven't gone away from that. But the origins of that centralized planning system was PPBS. It was McNamara bringing in the idea that we can predict. It was systems analysis, this idea that we can predict over long periods of time. And because of that, you know, when Packard came in, he just it created this, and Goldwater Nichols created this system that, you know, optimized this centrally planned system that is completely not based on time. And that's the system we live in. So yes, we have to figure out a way to decentralize, to allow tolerance for failure, to essentially start thinking not linearly, but orthogonally or in you know, almost like a quantum-based thinking of different ways and different relationships, and be encouraged to fail. But if we fail at a lower level, that's okay, because that's exactly what the VC guys do. You know, if a $20 million prototype doesn't work, big deal. You know, I've got five other guys I'm investing in. You know, it's a little worse when you got $100 million into it, but still you can do that.
Well, that's what DARPA was about too.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and DARPA was also the test case on other transactions as you know, and they were able to do in the 1990s and lay the groundwork for the best practices on how to do these type of prototyping type things. The problem we had, and that's what we faced in the mid 2000s, is there was nowhere for these things to go. Right. You create these wonderful operational prototypes, you want to build more of them, and you got to put it in the traditional contracting system, the traditional acquisition system, and so on, and these things just died. And so that's why we created a pathway to allow those type of DARPA prototypes to make it into production.
Yep. So I we're sort of getting closer to our timelines. I was going to ask you, if you were the Secretary of Defense tomorrow, what would you do to help make some of these changes occur?
I would focus on what we can achieve in the next 3 to 5 years and focus all my efforts on that. In other words, if we've got production lines, I would run them and keep them going, because that's capability we need to compete against China. But on innovation, I would essentially use these authorities, other transactions, mid-tier, completely bypass the current system and incentivize as much innovation, as much capability as we could possibly get in the next 5 years, because we're going to need it.
So how do you quell the antibodies in those departments that aren't being used very much?
Well, I mean, that's the problem. You're going to have to create a leadership that continuously follows up, and you're going to have to empower leaders down the line. And frankly, I think the most important people to empower is the program managers. That's the one thing Packard got right. Get good people, give them authority, and hold them accountable. And the accountability, what you're going to try to hold them accountable for, is get me capability to the warfighter as quickly as possible that is operationally useful and effective. And based on empowering them and then spending your time and spending all the political's time cutting through all of those barriers. And he's going to have to reach across into Congress and make this argument that these authorities are useful and need to be used and effectively used, because while these are authorization type languages, the appropriators are still stuck in 1963. And because of that, there's going to have to be a relationship change between the department and the appropriators to make this succeed.
Can we call it the Greenwald Act?
I'd rather have it Senator Reed, he can take credit for it, or Senator Shelby, I don't care.
You know, one other point on program managers that I'd like your thoughts on. What I see with these program managers, to the point we already made, they don't stay in the job long enough to get very much done in order to be held accountable. And two, now, at least in this Nav War world, and most of the Navy that I know of, they've formalized assistant program managers or principal assistant program managers. So effectively, the program managers become mini PEOs. And they're basically managing the process and talking to the sponsors on the Hill or in OPNAV to let the APMs be the program managers, but the APMs do not have Title 10 authority to be program managers. And the system has gotten very skewed because of that. I don't know if you see that the same way.
No, I do. I think tenure of program managers is huge. We tried to mandate a longer tenure. We got so much pushback on that. I think there's a lot of lessons learned in the career of a Rickover. You know, the first 10 years were probably the most innovative and best things, you know, we can get from people. And that's the type of thing we should get longer tenures like that. But later years on Rickover became more centralized management and kind of created some of the problems we have today. So there might be a sweet spot from 0 to 10 years. And after that, you might need to kind of move them on. So we shall see, but it's definitely not 2 years or 3 years.
But if we really did prototype OTAs, then 10 years would give you enough time to really put something out. You'd have a system into full production.
You could put three things out easily, you know, three versions of whatever it is you're doing. So that's the hope, but that's going to require a major culture change and lots of leadership, to drive that change.
So, Jim, do you have any more questions for Bill before we let him go back?
No, this has been fantastic. I would like to say let's do a follow-up in maybe 3 or 6 months and see if anything's changed.
Hopefully for the good.
Yes. Hopefully we'll see some good examples in the next 6 months to a year.
I just think that anyone looking at how we innovated with the vaccines has just got to see – we should just apply that to so much that the government does, particularly in national security. There are authorities we can use. We just have to use them. And it requires leadership and a threat pulled together. Well, we have the threat. We have the authorities. The issue is, do we have the leadership that's actually going to encourage and have the backs of those who are taking essentially risk and taking the initiative to innovate?
Actually, I want to make one other comment you reminded me of while you're talking then. George Friedman's most recent book about how we can change the world of strategic military capability, and talking about the military and the government, he made the point that I thought was fascinating. He said, what we should do to the entire federal government is treat them the way we treat our operational forces, which is operate by commander's intent. So if the commander's intent is to do whatever it is for the mission, and everybody below him knows, you interpret that the best you can and do the best you can, independent of whatever the other rules are, he thinks that actually could be brought into the rest of the federal government and change people from these very rigid bureaucratic processes to processes that would adapt to the commander's intent.
Well, and in the acquisition world and the budgeting world, we need to bring the commanders in and give them a greater say. So maybe the one thing that needs to be done from Goldwater-Nichols is to do just that, is to bring this divide that we have and bring them back together, but also ensuring the commanders are not just thinking of 12 months, but are thinking of 3 to 5 years or longer.
So what are you doing now, Bill, to help all us keep moving along?
Well, I'm over at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI, writing. I just recently did a report, and I'll recommend it to anybody who wants to read on this further. Unfortunately, it's like a 65-page report with a guy from former DARPA guy named Dan Pat called Competing in Time. And there we essentially look at the history of acquisition and the need for budget reform. I'm doing think tanking. I'm advising anybody who wants to listen to me, and just keep trying to figure out a way to implement all of, I think, these really great authorities that are out there that we need to use quickly to compete against our adversaries.
That's phenomenal. Well, I'd be happy to put a link, if there's a possible link for that, into the website when we post this.
No, and I'll be happy to provide.
Yeah, and I want to thank you for spending the time, and I thought the discussion was fascinating and useful and good, and it's great to talk to those who have been able to make all this possible to date. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill, for what you do. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here, Jim. Marv, thanks so much.
Stop.